Hello there, and welcome to Speaking of Our Words, radio programming that brings you the wide range of voices, stories, poems, and forms of local writers, and offering you some insight into their creative process. My name is Marshall Smith, and I am your host. I am a published poet and studied poetry at the University of Iowa Writers' Workshop graduate program. Today, our show will feature several guest writers. First, we have Irene Belak, we have Dave Gordeau, and we have Bob Katzman. We have several stories and poems for you to hear today, so why don't we get going? So first, we're going to hear from Irene. Irene, take it away.
Good afternoon. My commentary or little essay is called The Gift of Sight. At age 9, I noticed, my teacher noticed, as did my parents, that I was not seeing as well as I should. My father took me to an optometrist. We traveled by train to another town from Landeck to Innsbruck, Austria. The ride was fun on the fast-moving train, and traveling with my father was a very pleasant experience. I remember the myriad of spectacles in the doctor's office, many of which I tried. This was done in order to fit my eyes with the best prescription possible. My eyes were also examined with an eye machine. A prescription was determined, and I walked out with a new pair of glasses. The frame was pink. In my class, I became a star and a wonder because of my spectacles. I was the only one with them. My second grade friends wanted to try them on also. Since they did not need glasses, there was laughter and teasing who looked the best and from the distortions they saw. My teacher was happy for me as I could see everything she wrote on the board. I also saw everything around me very clearly. Because I was a scout and a good player of games, I did not wear my glasses every day except for school. My parents could not afford another pair if I broke the pair I had. The older I grew, my prescription changed to even a higher power. My eyes were becoming weaker. Many visits to the optometrist for many years became the routine with sophisticated measurements and prescriptions. Though seeing well, I began to dislike my spectacles very much. I was a teenager, and looks were very important to me. No matter what I wore, the thick glass lenses made my eyes beady-eyed, and the frames were an obstacle in my face, I thought. At 19, a sophomore in college, there was a big surprise that changed my life forever. In the student union, I saw a student rinsing what I later found out were contact lenses. I asked her many questions, and she explained to me that they were a replacement for framed glasses. Wow, I thought, finally I got my miracle. At times in church, I would cross myself and apply a bit of blessed water to my eyes. Was this my payoff for that? I did not know and didn't think so, but I accepted the wonderful change. My colleague told me the name of her optometrist. I immediately called and made an appointment. Dr. O.J. Miller made me feel welcome, explained the procedure for testing my eyes, and how the plastic lenses worked. 2 hours on, 2 hours off, he said, until I would get used to my eyelids, getting strong, tough, and slide easily over the lenses. I was a successful and happy patient, so much so that Dr. Miller hired me to be his assistant and explained the procedure to our patients. Of course, my mother was upset with this change when she saw me tearing up while wearing the lenses at first. "You'll go blind," she said. Many assurances and successful practices finally convinced her of my happiness. The fact that I was employed part-time with Dr. Miller while going to school made her very proud. "Irene is working for a doctor," she told her friends. Later, I changed hard lenses for soft ones, was fitted with the more sophisticated ones as soon as they were available, and which I could wear sleeping for 2 weeks at a time. Imagine being able to see everything well upon waking. Of course, that was somewhat expensive, but I saved up for this change. I have worn contact lenses for over 60 years, even though my prescription for distance was very high. My good sight was a miracle to me. All I needed was reading glasses. I was able to see well, read and write, and observe just like everyone else who could see well. I was very grateful. But then, another change. A cloud was forming over my eyes, and my optometrist, Dr. Thomas, said cataracts were clouding my vision and were at a point where surgery was needed. I needed surgery to remove the cataracts and get implants for my vision. More tests, drops, and finally, a date was set. Dr. Steven Slana performed 2 surgeries within a month. First the weaker right eye, then the left, several weeks later. I could not believe it. Perfect 20/20 vision. No pain, no hindrance. Another miracle. Thanks to Dr. Thomas and Dr. Slana for their professionalism, their expertise, and care. Dr. Slana performed the successful surgery at Frederick Kenosha Hospital this past December 2017. His skillful hands returned my sight with implants. I have fantastic vision. Today, he is in the Dominican Republic doing surgeries for impoverished people free of charge. God bless him in his work. Eyes, a window to the world. Eyes, a window to your soul. Eyes, a mirror to your heart. Eyes gleaming with joy. Eyes reflecting sadness or sorrow. The gift of sight restored.
Thank you, Irene. That was very nice. Let me ask you a question, if I may. How did you happen to write that? What motivated you, caused you to want to write that?
Just these past surgeries in December, I was amazed at what the doctors could do with somebody who had a -8 on one eye and -10.5 on the other. It was really a miracle, and I wanted to tell people about it. I was also very grateful to the doctors who helped to make this happen.
I'm sure that made them very happy, to your joy and being able to see so well again. That's really special. So I'm curious. Also, additionally, did you write that? Did you just spin it out and it came out in one writing, or did you spend a lot of time editing and going back over it? You know, there are a lot of, you know, for instance, Mozart used to just spin pieces out, and Beethoven tortured over them, and you know, rewrote. And I'm curious about your style, if you tend to kind of just spin it out, or you tend to really torturously edit.
I started it out as a poem with the ending that I said, eyes open to the world and so on. But I couldn't seem to get a hang on it. It was not what I really wanted to say in a poem form. So then I changed it to an article. And then, as you say, I kind of spinned it. It went well.
Ah, that's very interesting. That's very interesting. So as a poem, it just wasn't explicit enough, perhaps?
Or? No, it wasn't. And it wasn't. Perhaps I should have started writing it, you know, long ago, and maybe I could have done that. But I only did it the last few weeks, and I just couldn't have the time or the ambition to sit with it.
there's a lot of nostalgia in that piece too, because you talk about your father and going to Austria and those cities in Europe, and that must have been a rich experience writing about that time.
Yes, it was. It was. I was an immigrant from Ukraine living in Austria in a displaced persons camp. And there was no optometrist in our displaced persons camp. So, of course, we had to travel to Innsbruck.
Very nice. Very nice. Thank you for bringing that.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So, next. Next, we have perhaps Bob Katzman.
Yes.
Bob, will you read for us?
Yes. It's Robert M. Katzman. I brought, depending on time, one or two things. In answer to the question you asked the lady, they arrive fully formed, and it's up to me to write them down before they disappear. So I don't understand that. It's like two minds working at the same time.
Well, there's something platonic in that. Go ahead.
All right. Relationships defined. A Closer to Reality Reflection, written on New Year's Eve, 2017. 1. Friend, one of one or one of many, a preferred person to call, go places with, share experiences, be with when sad or drunk, to defend or be defended by when threatened by words or worse, and who, when you ask for help, absolutely, positively, shows up. 2. Best friend, all of the above. Never more than one or two people if a person is not deluded about what the words actually mean. When you tell your darkest, who you tell your darkest secrets to, and who, when you need to be told what a jerk you are, or how to rescue some hopeless situation, career mistake, or if he or she is the one, you listen. 3. Girl or boyfriend. Same meaning. Again. All of two, except the one who was on the same wavelength as, try it again. Same, meaning again, all of two except the one who was on the same wavelength as you are about sex, passion, politics, anger, and thinking about your futures together, maybe. Someone who you can travel with for more than 3 days, and despite all the grief, you can bring down upon both of you when your scheduled plans and connections don't work as they should have, you still don't hate them. Think about it. 4. Married. Take 3. Add pressure. Children. Failure. No time anymore for anyone but 2. And not to ever speak of 3 in any way at any time in the sense of comparisons in beauty, success, or more deadly aspects of intimacy. Mix in a mysteriously biologically intense attraction that makes all the restrictions and disappointments bearable, because you still have each other and will quietly accept each other's old number twos, but rigidly never bringing up burning sex drives, except good, smart children who will never be president, and realizing that at a certain point, which arrives at the speed of a comet, that they are the oldest people at all of the family parties. Their children are balding or wrinkly. Their grandchildren are in high school and in another universe technologically, and nothing you overhear them saying makes any sense to you. You cling together at family reunions because you two are the only ones who remember well all the people who used to be in the room at parties like this one you are at, but realize that you were too busy to talk to those remote people because they were so old and boring. But now you know what treasures they took with them when they died, and most unexpectedly that you too have become them. You have learned to stop comparing current world or political events to the major ones of your own lives, because all that greets you are blank faces from your younger family, because no one remembers or cares about what was once so important to you. In the best of marriages, the once crowded spaceship of all you once knew that was traveling through time with you has shrunk to an increasingly rickety, increasingly emptying of other passengers, and the level of fuel left in your older model spaceship is dropping swiftly, and not all the gauges work properly anymore. the once steel-like belief that as a couple, you were both in this forever, begins to crumble when you realize that was never true. But now, more than ever, there will one day, one unknown day, be a sole survivor hurtling through time alone. 5. Finding love again. A necessary decision to believe that there must be God who determines such remote possibilities actually exist. Because all of the above, 1 through 4, have already happened, will never be able to happen again because old experiences with an earlier love can't be recreated, only remembered. Worse, the single person who speaks endlessly of them creates an impenetrable barrier, blocking any hope of emotional intimacy with anyone else who in many ways is your twin, except the museum of your own stunning past that you have built and barricaded guarantees that you will always be the only visitor to that fading museum. The lucky few who may successfully comprehend that less is more, meaning that less time moving backwards and more time with someone new moving forward, and that love is very different after 60, but that having someone to call, be with, to do things with, and holding each other's hands while slowly walking through a park in autumn, looking deeply into each other's eyes with a very different sense of what is important, means a kiss between two once solitary grandparents can be incredibly cool and hot. Happy New Year from a person who is currently floating somewhere in the universe between 4 and 5 and who believes there still may be time for the possibility of a second true love. Yes, I believe.
Very nice, Robert. Very nice. I like the museum of our history. Is that the phrase?
Yes.
Yes, I enjoy that. As I'm listening to you reflect on your experiences that feed into your definitions, 1 through how many? Are there 5 or
5?
5. It causes me to wonder what it would be like for you to have done that, and we could compare them if it was, say, 30 years ago. You could write the same definitions and see how it would be different, how you looked at it then versus now as you write this.
I was married to the same woman 30 years ago, 42 years ago. So I don't know. I didn't want to make 10 categories because there's 10 commandments, and I didn't want to be pretentious. So I thought I'd limit it to what I felt was the most comprehensible way of defining a way of gauging the meaning of relationships and their intensity. And this is a way of dealing with loss for me. I translate my emotions to words, and then they're fixed.
To Marshall's point, it's interesting that you, because I think you say in there somewhere that love is different after 60.
Yes. Right?
Describe very well what love's like now. It'd be interesting to have seen how you would have described it 30 years ago, to Marshall's point.
A person asked me if I were able to find a woman that could stand me and that I was compatible with, as far as she was concerned. What if this female friend of mine asked, what if she didn't like me? And I answered her that I wouldn't want to be with anyone that didn't like my friends. Which answered her question pretty clearly. If you like the person and each of you hates their friends, what kind of relationship is that? You know, sit in a room alone. So I think it's a hard thing, but I know that the woman I ended up with for 42 years was extremely persistent in trying to get it across to me that I was going to be the person in her life. She came to my wooden newsstand every single day, dressed to kill, and I'm dressed to sell newspapers. And she wouldn't go away until after 30 days when I closed, I kept her inside the newsstand, which made her happy or made me happy. I don't know. I think women want what they want, and they're not nearly as demure as we pretend that they are.
Very interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. I love the evolution of thinking about relationships and people. And it's true. We all, as we grow older, we change our perspective because a lot of things change, and even within our own bodies, as alluded mm-hmm. to. So it's very interesting. Thank you very much. Do you have another piece, did you say?
Sure.
Would you
it's
please?
Not very long, and it's poetry. To me, all my poems are stories, and they're stories with all the extra words chiseled away. So that's, I like to kind of get to the point with them. I have a website called Different Slants, SLANTS.com, in case anybody wants to read this work online. 7 Mile Road, October 30, 2015. Saturday afternoon, late autumn, unfamiliar country road. I keep losing rock and roll on my radio, hunt and peck, and I miss my damn exit. Cursing the wasted time, I turn east on what? I look for a sign, 7 Mile Road, stretching into the horizon, no stoplights in sight. I zoom ahead. Then I see it, a clear horizon, harvested fields, a perimeter of trees framing the emptiness, V's of birds flying south, fall past its glory? I don't see that. I slow down, pull over on the dirt, engulfed in too much sober beauty for me to go any farther, radio silent. I take it in, I try to take it in, and entranced as only a city boy could be. Dusty, dull gray road, a concrete ocean, rising and falling, my old car a rusty shipwreck, if I will let it be, and I do, cresting on a swell, I take in a dying fall. Black bony fingers, half empty of leaves, stretching up to heaven, supplicating trees, beseeching to survive, naked into winter, abandoned nests, nestled in nooks, half-light imprinting defenseless branches across empty fields. How do I describe the colors, what I saw that day on 7 Mile Road? I am only a person, and words are so limited. If I type red, white, and blue, flat words on a page, but if I write burned and bullet-riddled and goddammit still-standing American flag, strong men can be moved to tears. Words matter. These are the colors I saw in a rural paint box. Feathered wheat, tea-stained paper, murmuring pallid dignity of an ancient brittle Hebrew scroll. Yellows as vibrant and glowing as a bubbling egg yolk, muffled and mottled ranges of rust, fading against each other. Browns as rich and welcoming as deep, dark chocolates. Purple oak leaves, veins as thick as the back of a hand of a Georgia field worker. Reds. How to explain the reds? Barely tipped green leaves, as subtle a crimson as a maiden's blush. Burnt orange, dirty yellow, so many of them, distinct and vibrant as flame. Screaming, bloody, red, flowing and pulsing from a bleeding, wounded soldier crying, look at me, while I still breathe. Reader, close your eyes and imagine the range of gasping beauty, compelling me to foolishly try to make any of you see what I saw, like offering each of you invisible flowers. Massed carpets of leaves, numberless in anonymity, brown and crinkling, curling into vein tubes, Wisconsin cannoli, swirling in whirlpools, then collapsing, dark skin disintegrating, becoming earth. Distant horizon, a thin blue line, fading light, blending, peeling red barns, black magic marker trees, jagged, stalkless fields, breathtaking, 7 Mile Road, just before the end, I stare into the silence, gray concrete waves sailing me home.
Very nice, Robert. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was nice. So, did I hear you say that this was a story or a piece of prose that you reduced to a poem? Did I hear you say something like that?
It's a mindset. This actually happened. When I first moved here a couple of years ago, I kept missing my exits when I started daydreaming. Or sometimes I write things in my head when I'm driving, and every time I miss my exit. And so this particular time, I had never been on 7 Mile Road. It was a great day. I had no idea what I was going to encounter, and my annoyance just flew away because I was transformed by the oh, the enormity of the range of colors. I'm the child of an interior decorator, and all over my house as a young child there were charts with 30 kinds of red, 30 kinds of brown, and 30 kinds of blue, 30 kinds of white, 30 kinds of black. And then I went to art school for 6 years. And people who have that experience see the world much more vividly. It's like we can tune things in on binoculars and see things vividly. I believe that. And so this came as a poem because I wanted to say as much as possible as quickly as possible, so people would ride along with me in the car.
Very nice, very nice. And so when you create this poem, or this might go to other poems that you create, and usually or very often poets have different styles at different times or different styles even within their own more current work, depending on what how they see the poem's shape. How did you imagine writing this? You know, when I'm thinking more in terms of things like, you know, a meter, or did you use any of that, or did it just kind of come out this way, or how do you think of your poems?
I think of it as a ballad without music. There is a rhythm, and it's in my head. I can start it, but sometimes it starts by itself. And at those times, like at Vad Yashem in Jerusalem, the Holocaust Museum, I got this entire poem going, and it was awful, about an awful experience, and I got a security guard to give me paper, sat down in the entrance to the museum and scribbled it right there, because I knew that if I waited, I'd lose it. Stories are when I want to define something so carefully in much greater detail and create an atmosphere that's either entertaining or frightening or romantic. And I want the story to take the time to weave itself. And that can be done once I have the basic concept. A poem is like air blowing through my ear, and it's going to go right out the other ear if I don't grab it. And it's always been that way. I have my first poem from 1958. It's about walking to school, and I wrote about walking to school. As far as the length of the stanzas, since I never studied English in college and have no formal training in writing, thank God, and probably can't use all the formal terms to describe what I write. It's just how I feel. It's a paragraph. I said all I wanted to say in this paragraph, and if someone's reading it, I want them to have a chance to let their eyes rest, and then the next paragraph, because if there's too much together, people can lose their place. That may sound simple, but that's my thinking. Give people a chance to think about what they just read. And it's my own style because I made it up. I didn't follow anybody else's instructions or study haiku or want to. The one major change when I grew up, I don't know when that was, is I found out that poetry doesn't rhyme. It doesn't have to rhyme. I have this massive amount of poetry that rhymes. And when I found out it didn't have to, Jesus Christ, it's like all the chains were taken off. It's like, wait, instead of walking, I could run now? That was liberation. It was letting the slaves out. I can write rhyming poetry now, but it seems like an exercise in mathematics compared to the honesty of feeling of writing free verse poetry.
Well, that's a very interesting concept there about rhyme. And, you know, rhyme was, in iambic pentameter and all this stuff that you talk about from English classes that, you know, Shakespeare, of course, wrote in that with some variations along the way where the accent was. But that was an external structure. that over time, when free verse emerged, suddenly the poems internalized their structure. And that internalized structure is really interesting. And it then became sort of a way in the last century that poems that rhyme the rhyme is distracting from the true meaning of the poem, which is internal inside the poem. And so you go to that notion of an internalized structure versus externalized. And then there was a lot of poetry that continued to be written in rhyme that was humorous, and it worked in that way very much so. But that's a very interesting, a lot of very astute comments there, and you know, it's a continuing discussion. I find it very, very interesting.
I can add one more sentence.
Please do.
Which is that the beauty to me of free verse is that a single word can represent a sentence, a thought by itself. It deserves its own moment of breath.
Very good. As can that be the case in haiku. You can have a single word because, and it can be a single line and a single idea. So that's kind of a cool thing, too.
I'll meet a Japanese woman, and then I'll suddenly decide. I'll be open to it.
Well, thank you very much, Robert. And I'll bring up your website again at the conclusion of our session here so that...
thank you.
Yes. Because I think Robert has quite a big body of work on his website, if I'm not mistaken.
You're not.
Dave, could you read something for us?
Sure. Please? Before I start, I just want to comment on 7 Mile Road. It's a very beautiful part of the country, but you're probably not aware of this. In the 70s, when I was a kid, they were constantly finding body parts. It was on the news, another bag of body parts was found on 7 Mile Road. So I don't mean to shatter your idyllic vision of it. But
that might have thrown the poem off.
It ended up a year later being the road I went on hundreds of times to take my wife to the Aurora St. Luke's Hospital. We could have gone to a faster road, but she saw a horse she liked, and we went to see the horse every time.
It is pretty out there. Okay, well, I have a couple of things that I'd like to read.
Please do. Dave Gordeau.
One short and one, the other one's very short. First one is a memoir I wrote several years ago called Snow Day. That seemed appropriate given our weather here lately. So here goes. It had started snowing late the night before, and it continued through the Saturday morning, ending just about noon. All told, we got about 3 inches of the stuff. I was 23 years old, and we were living in the upstairs apartment on 18th Avenue at the time. He had nothing to do and nowhere to go for the rest of the weekend. Shortly after noon, after it stopped snowing, I put on the old army fatigue jacket that Jack Anderson had given me about 3 years earlier, a stocking cap, a pair of gloves, and my rubber boots. On the back landing, just outside of the entrance to our apartment, I grabbed a little metal snow shovel and began clearing off the steps of the stairway. It was cold, but not too cold, probably in the low 20s. It felt warmer when the clouds moved out and were replaced by the bright January sun. The snow was light and powdery, and I felt good as I moved to the bottom of the steps. Next, I cleared the little gravel driveway we shared with the woman who rented the downstairs apartment. Once I finished that, I started on the sidewalk in front of the house. Compared to the rutted gravel and driveway, the sidewalk was a breeze, and I was able to quickly get to the end of the property line. The house our apartment in was in bordered a vacant lot that was the corner of 18th Avenue and 45th Street. I'd been outside only a few minutes and had cleared the back steps, the driveway, and the sidewalk in front of our house. I felt good and had nothing else to do, so I figured, what the hell? I may as well keep going. I cleared the sidewalk to 45th Street, then heading east, I cleared that side of the corner lot. When that was done, I found myself in front of another old two-story house with sidewalks and a driveway that hadn't been cleared yet. I felt good and didn't want to stop, so I kept going and started on the sidewalk in front of the house. About halfway through, the front door opened. An old, frail man I'd never met before stood in the doorway. "Thank you," he said. "Don't mention it," I replied. "Would you mind doing my driveway, too?" "Sure, no problem," I said, quickly surveying the short cement two-car driveway. With the snow this powdery and light, I figured I could knock it off in a few minutes. "Thank you so much," he said, and went back inside. I quickly finished the sidewalk in front of his house, and it didn't take me long to do his driveway. Every now and then I'd glance to the window, and each time he was standing there, stooped over, watching me. I finished the driveway and turned my attention to the short cement walkway that ran from the sidewalk to his front porch. I made quick work of it, and just as I was finishing up, the front door opened again. My guess was that he was going to offer me a few bucks for my work. "Thank you again," he said. "When you finish up, why don't you come inside for a few minutes?" I nodded my head, and he closed the door. It was only a couple of more minutes when I finished. Standing on the steps to the front door, I was just about to knock when it opened. "Come on in, come on in." I stepped in, and he took my coat, and I took off my boots. He motioned for me to sit in a chair in his living room. Then he went to the kitchen. He came back with two glasses filled with a golden brown liquid. "Cold out there, huh?" he said, handing me a glass. "Not too bad," I said. "Well, drink some of this. This will warm you up." He sat in a chair across from me. It was warm and very good. I was able to recognize it as brandy. We sat in the warmth of his living room, surrounded by framed photos of what I assumed to be children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren. The room looked like it belonged to a bygone era. We talked about the cold. We talked about his health. There was something wrong with his lungs that made breathing cold air difficult. But mostly he talked about brandy and how whatever kind it was that we were drinking was top-of-the-line stuff. When the first glass was finished, he brought me a second glass, this one of a different, more famous make, and he explained to me why the second one was inferior to the first. I didn't know anything about any of that. I just knew they were both warm and good. We sat and drank brandy and talked for about a half hour. After I finished the second glass, he offered me a third, which I politely declined, saying if I drank any more, I might not be able to find my way around the corner to home. I got up and put my boots and coat on, and as he thanked me again, I took one long last look at his living room. It was so warm and comfortable. There's always been something sacred, something even holy, about people's living rooms, especially the ones belonging to strangers who invite you in. It was about 3 o'clock when I left and started back for home, feeling a little bit of a buzz from the brandy and a contented ache in my bones from the work and the cold air. The sun was still out, but lowering in the west. I grabbed my shovel and walked back home. I was 23 years old, and the future lay out before me like an undisturbed coat of fresh snow on an endless city sidewalk, waiting to be uncovered.
Very nice, Dave. Thank you.
Thanks.
Ominous. I had experiences like that from a priest and a security guard, different men at different time that entice you when you're too young to quite understand that they're enticing you. I remember.
I still don't think he was actually, there's anything untoward about it. He was just a friendly guy who's into brandy.
Offering you glass after glass?
Yeah.
Well, that's how it comes across that way. Mm. But maybe only to people who've had the experience of somebody doing something that could be detrimental. Anyway, the story is effective because that's what it made me think
maybe,
of.
Maybe I'm naive.
Even if you didn't want it to.
Mm. I didn't take it that way. I took it as a surprise how you were ushered into this world. And I love the line, something secret and holy about people's living rooms, especially strangers, if I'm quoting that quite correctly. And it seemed like that something very special had taken place for you. And, of course, you were going away, and you may never see that person again, but it seemed like there was a very special moment for you, spiritually almost.
Yeah, it was one of those great days where you're young and you're kind of aware of it. Most of the time when you're young, you're not even aware of it. You just assume that's how it is. But I just remember being keenly aware that day of how good I felt, how good the work felt, how good my muscles felt, and how good the brandy tasted, and that this guy appreciated me, you know. So.
I guess, yeah.
And you, did you begin to learn about brandy after that?
No.
Yeah.
No, I never became a connoisseur.
Yeah, okay.
What did you charge? $2? When you said you... I think you said you were getting a couple of dollars.
Oh, no, I expected him to offer me a couple bucks for clearing his driveway, but instead he gave me a glass of brandy.
Instead?
Mm-hmm. Which is fine. I would have done it for nothing.
What a deal. Yeah. All right.
Like I said, that whole day was, I would have been happy just shoveling sidewalks the whole day. It was a perfect day.
Is that what caused you to write it?
Because
it was that day was crystallized as a perfect day.
And I still remember it so vividly here almost 40 years later. And for some reason.
May I say something very brief about snow
Sure.
system?
Sure.
It's all right?
Please.
Very brief. About the economics of learning what the market price is when you're 10 and you have a snow shovel and you want money. I went next door and asked the lady there, can I shovel your snow? And it's 25 cents. And she said, okay. And I did that. And then she gave me 50 cents. I thought, 25 was too little. So I went to the next house and told the person there that I would shovel their driveway for 50 cents. And they gave me $1. This is all true. And then the third house, same thing, except I asked for $1 and they gave me $1. And I shoveled snow all the way around the block and discovered that $1 was the market price. By the time I got home, I decided that was not enough money to do that much work.
So you should have asked for $1.25 and see how that
went. No, I hit the market. It was consumer driven.
Okay. Very good. Dave, do you have another piece, did you say?
Very, very quickly. This is something I noodle around with. I'm not a poet. And it's interesting the discussion we had earlier about rhyme versus not rhyme. I'm a huge fan of the singer-songwriter genre of music, Dylan, Springsteen, and those guys.
Bruce.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huge fan of them, but I don't have any musical talent whatsoever. Not a lick of it. So what I did is I loved those lyrics. So I figured I'd write some lyrics, recognizing this isn't poetry, but song lyrics, but there's no melody. So I'll give this a shot. You guys can laugh and tell me how corny it is. I know it is. I'll follow you down. You know wherever you are is where I want to be. I promise I will follow you if you promise you will wait for me. If you promise you will wait for me. Now tonight it's cold outside. Cold and dark all through this town. But it's warm here by your sleeping side. Your skin and the covers in your hair are spilling round. Just let me stay here and I'll follow you down. I'll follow you down to the blackest depths of despair. And I'll shine a light in the darkness we find down there. Now it's getting late. The streets are all empty. The dogs are in. I've got nowhere to go and nothing else to do except to carve our names in the wind. There's a rumbling hum of a freight train rolling in the distance again. We've both been everywhere it's been. We both know where those tracks are bound. Climb aboard, we'll let them swallow us down. And there ain't no god in them clouds up above. There's just a devil to pay, flames all around. I don't care because I know that you're there. Say the word and I'll follow you down. Say the word and I'll follow you down.
Why aren't they poetry?
It's kind of cliche-ish, I think.
It's not bad poetry. I mean, if you feel that way. I think lyric is just another way of saying poetry.
What do you think, Marshall? I think the lyrics are bound by kind of stricter rules that kind of limit it.
I think that song lyrics can be poetry. They're often standing alone, terrible poetry. But I like your piece, by the way, before I go any further on that point. But there are some song lyrics, and of course Dylan won the prize,
right?
That are particularly profound and great poetry. Paul Simon was a great poet, is a great poet, another one of those people. So I think the rhyme in lyrics it's just part of the that's the way you do it when you write songs and lyrics,
right?
Usually. Not always, but usually. But I like your piece because I'm not hearing distraction. I used that word earlier of rhyme or anything. I'm hearing your emotions raw coming through for how you feel about what's happening there. So I think Robert's point that, he asked the question, why isn't it poetry? If you feel it is, then it is a poem from your heart. Now, how we evolve from those places of writing our first poems, and that's not your first poem, I'm not sure. I'm quite sure of that. But is to read and learn and read and read and read. And when we read poets, we learn how this really, really works. And I'm only bringing that up relative to the notion of Robert saying that you write a poem and you go, that's a poem. I like what I wrote. And then you read some stuff and you go, well, I might be able to make that a little bit better if I did some different things. Mm-hmm. And that's how it all goes. And that's how life goes, right? And
it's like 30 days. You go back 30 days later and you think, what was I thinking? And then you start making changes. Because while you're in the creative process, you're not necessarily using all of your brain. And it's amazing how things seem different a month later.
I think I've only recently started trying to write poetry again. When I try and write real poetry, I'm just kind of channeling something that's coming from within, and it's getting it out. When I wrote this thing, it's interesting you said rhyme is a distraction earlier. I struggled so hard to find a couple of rhymes that I thought, well, this isn't really very honest emotion. This is just me kind of. So I think that's the difference. That's why I don't consider it a poem. You know, it's more trying to find the best rhyme that fits the way I feel. That's not the same as describing the way I feel. You know?
Right. That's how free verse developed, yeah. Partially. Exactly what you just said. That's an element of that.
I want to offer
change.
A contradictory opinion. I can't look at you when I do this. I'm publishing a book called I Seek the Praise of Ordinary Men, which came about after an interview of a working man. It's actually a call to arms poem against the war, second Bush. And it rhymes, because I didn't know any other way to express it. And there's a lot of power in it. And I don't have prejudice against my earlier way of expressing myself. Sometimes it's musical. Sometimes there's something about it that just flows. And it works. I don't even know the mystery of poetry. But it's like it's writing itself. So I would never myself be critical of someone else writing poetry because I felt wonderfully expressive, if that's all you know.
I think that you are exactly right on. I don't think we're ready to throw away all that old body of poetry that is beautiful rhyming poetry. And that would never be the intention either when, say, the Imagists of, the William Carlos Williams and even Eliot and began to discard some of the rhyme. That was never their intention. It was because we were evolving into a different place. So, and everybody had learned from the past, and they decide, well, what if we did an off rhyme instead of a rhyme? What if we changed the form? What if we threw in different meter and different accents at different places? So it's more a matter of just the evolution. I think if anybody who wants to write rhyme, that's great. That may come from their heart, yeah.
I'll ask you, because I don't know, you're running this. Unless you want to read something or he wants to read something, I didn't know that I brought this, but I did. And this is actually what it is. I'm standing on a beach in southeastern Wisconsin. And I just sat there. I was so disturbed that the beach is gone. What happened to the beach? So I've been gone for a month. And I just sat there upset. And then it's like this thing happened in my head. And this just came out in minutes. And to me, it's a song. So, I mean, if you wanted to hear it, you can hear it.
I have before me a couple of pieces by Richard Bell, who is in our guild, our Writers Guild, and I'm going to read this. Richard was unable to be here. And this is called Flying High by Richard Bell from his book Life Seemed Good, But... In his dream, Simon had been flying with outstretched arms through the puffy white clouds and around the high power lines, zooming about with the confidence of an eagle. It was a great high, and he wanted it to continue, awake now and lying in bed with his girlfriend and his calico cat. He wished he could really fly like that and continued to ponder it in his daydreaming at work. Was it possible to create something like a surfboard that could interface with the powerful yet delicate magnetic field of the earth in order to hover above the ground and fly? He became determined to find out. As autumn went by, Simon bought a used surfboard and a soldering kit and scavenged all kinds of copper and zinc wire, batteries, lasers, and an assortment of who knows what electronic and computer stuff. And, of course, rolls of aluminum foil. He stayed up all hours of the night, missed work a lot, and, unfortunately, lost his job. Despite his odd but diligent research, he had no positive results. One day his girlfriend informed him of her plans to leave because of his obsession, his immature fart humor, and because she liked to sleep with the window slightly open, and he kept it slightly closed, since Simon intensely disliked being cold. So goodbye. She departed, and his only source of nourishment became junk food, beer, and cheese puffs. He worked like a man possessed, trying everything imaginable, but the stupid surfboard wouldn't fly. It just sat there like a pile of junk, mocking him. 2 months later, the paunchy, balding sheriff informed him that he was being evicted for non-payment of rent, and serious-looking men came and turned off the phone and the water. Then they disconnected the heat. At the end of his rope, Simon purchased an illegal green leafy substance from certain local teenagers whose identities are being withheld. He reasoned that since a dream had begun this project, a dream was needed to provide the inspiration to finish it. Late that fateful evening, he lit up, inhaled the smoke, and went to his basement in a state of reverie. Guided by otherworldly visions, Simon rewired the board in a complex new pattern. He adjusted the voltage regulator, applied a larger charge from the battery, and gawked in amazement as the surfboard lifted up off the ping pong table and hovered in midair. The cat ran and hid while a deep electric humming noise, like giant bees on steroids, filled the room. With joy overflowing, Simon took the surfboard outside and, sitting astride it, with a glass fishbowl on his head, applied a slightly higher charge from the car battery strapped to the back of the board. Immediately, he felt a rush of wind and watched helplessly as the ground vanished from under his feet. 20 minutes later, the cold vacuum of space silenced his scream, not exactly what he had in mind in terms of getting high. The next day, the sheriff returned with a warrant of eviction. He knocked and, receiving no answer, entered through the unlocked door and searched the house, whereupon he found the baggie of leafy material hidden in a smelly old shoe. Remember, kids, dangerous shoes are illegal here. A stray bullet frightened the cat into the yard, and it ran away without a word. Everyone assumed Simon had skipped out and gone to live with his mom in New York City. Today, Simon's frozen body rides the surfboard through the solar system and will likely plunge into the sun in, looking at my watch, 400 years. Thank you very much, Richard. We can't inquire with you about your piece, but perhaps another time. I think because we have only about 4 minutes left, we're going to ask Robert to read his piece.
Okay.
Because I think that will fit the time frame just perfectly.
Give it a shot. I'm standing on a beach in southeastern Wisconsin, and the waves are rolling in without exception, and each wave is a mirror of the thousands, waves like an invasion, a war upon our beaches. Each assault against the sand, churning up a cloud of prisoners who are sucked back in the rear of those thousands of waves, and the beach is disappearing. And the trees meant to withstand the waves' endless hunger keep falling at their post, ripped out and torn asunder, wood all bleached and dying, leaves still on their branches, each one never knowing that this fall will be their last one. Soon will go the dunes with their tall grasses meant to hold them, but those grasses won't hold them. They can't protect the beaches as those waves keep rolling in without exception. 5 million people in Wisconsin, but none of them here with me to see their state is disappearing as I watch the shore being bitten as if by blind, insatiable creatures whose appetite will never, never be satisfied. My God, what is happening? I'm standing on a beach in southeastern Wisconsin, and the waves are rolling in without exception, and each wave is a mirror of the thousands, waves like an invasion, a war upon our beaches. We can't win.
Very nice. I'm glad we had time to read that.
In a single breath. How did he finish the contraption without the electricity? They turned off water, light, phone. I just thought I'd.
Maybe we can ask him when we see him.
When we see
him. Okay. I think we have just enough time for me to, I'm going to read a poem that I admire a great deal by someone who's now dead. He taught at the University of Montana in their writer's program, and his name is Richard Hugo. Degrees of Gray in Phillipsburg. You might come here Sunday on a whim, say your life broke down, the last good kiss you had was years ago. You walk these streets laid out by the insane, past hotels that didn't last, bars that did, the tortured try of local drivers to accelerate their lives. Only churches are kept up. The jail turns 70 this year. The only prisoner is always in, not knowing what he's done. The principal supporting business now is rage, hatred of the various grays the mountain sends, hatred of the mill, the silver bill repeal, the best like girls who leave each year for Butte. One good restaurant and bars can't wipe the boredom out. The 1907 boom, 8 going silver mines, a dance floor built on springs. All memory resolves itself in gaze, in panoramic green you know the cattle eat, or 2 stacks high above the town, 2 dead kilns, the huge mill in collapse for 50 years now that won't fall finally down. Isn't this your life? That ancient kiss still burning out your eyes? Isn't this defeat so accurate? The church bell simply seems a pure announcement ring and no one comes. Don't empty houses ring? Are magnesium and scorn sufficient to support a town? Not just Phillipsburg, but towns of towering blondes, good jazz and booze. The world will never let you have until the town you came from dies inside. Say no to yourself. The old man 20, when the jail was built, still laughs, although his lips collapse. Someday soon, he says, I'll go to sleep and not wake up. You tell him no. You're talking to yourself. The car that brought you here still runs. The money you buy lunch with, no matter where it's mined, is silver. And the girl who serves your food is slender, and her red hair lights the wall. So that will...
That's great.
That will conclude our session. I want to ask our guests, do any of you writers have websites, if you would...
I do. It's www.differentslants.com. It's one word, and slants is spelled S-L-A-N-T-S. Thank you.
Great. Do you, Dave, have any?
Yeah, I have one called Drivel by Dave, and the address is djgourdoux .com. Yeah.
Very good, very good. Dave heads our Kenosha Writers Guild, and I would like to ask him to plug that for a moment.
Sure. We're a free group, open to the public. We meet on the second and third Thursdays of every month. The third Thursday is our normal, regular meeting. Second Thursday, we usually have in-depth critiques or a special topic, workshop, or a featured guest. We meet at Carthage College in the Strass Hall, room 196, I think it is.
It overlooks the lake.
Yeah, it's a beautiful room.
Yeah.
And you want to know any more information, go to our website, KenoshaWritersGuild.com.
Very good, very good. So this show, this radio show, is a production of the Kenosha's Writer Guild. If you have any questions or comments or wish to participate in this program, please visit KenoshaWritersGuild.com and come to one of our meetings. Please visit the Facebook and YouTube pages for this show, Speaking of Our Words, and feel free to leave a comment. So thanks to Dave Cole of WGTD, Steve Brown and Nita Hunter, our engineer today, Russ Weller, Lisa Adamowitz Kless, and the Kenosha Writers Guild. Thank you so very much to all of our guests, Irene Belak, Dave Gordeau, and Robert Katzman. And I'm Marshall Smith. Remember, the world needs your poems and stories. We will see you again. Thank you for listening.